Recording has started.
Okay, great, thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Excuse me, welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms Subteam for Data Call held on Monday, the 18th of June, 2018. On the call today, we have Kathy Kleiman, Christine Durain, Michael Graham, and Rebecca Tushnet. We have no apologies at this time. Susan Payne will be joining us late. From staff, we have Ariel Liang, Julie Headland, Mary Wong, and Antonetta Mangiacotti, and myself, Julie Bisland. And I'd like to remind everyone to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to you, Julie Headland. Please begin.
Thank you so much, Julie Bisland. So thanks, everyone, for joining and at the new time. So just to ask, thank you also, Christine, for sending those two documents. I'm just wondering if all of you had a thought of which one we wanted to start with, would like to, and I see we don't have Greg or Stacy. Yeah, they are supposed to be on. While we are, here comes Stacy. Okay, very good. So while they are joining, Then let me ask, what is your preference as far as the documents that Christine has sent? Do you want to go back to the matrix, or staff was wondering if maybe we wanted to go ahead and continue the discussion that we had on the registrant survey and the hypothetical questions and the proposal that Christine has sent? Not hearing, seeing, yes. And Christine, I was hoping that you would raise your hand. Thank you.
Thanks. This is Christine. Oh, and I see Kathy's raising her hand also. I think where we left off was discussing those hypotheticals or those use cases or whatever we're calling the end of the registrant survey and talking about how it interacted with the potential registrant survey. So I do think we should, I think we've already sort of discussed what was there. We decided that we weren't real happy with the way it was originally drafted. So I'm going to propose that we take a look at what I sent, and if everybody hates it, then that's fine. We can start over or ask analysis group to go again. But I would be interested just to get some feedback if there are things about what I sent that people liked or that they didn't like was, up for discussion. Thanks. Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, and just a moment. So thanks, and everybody, please. I did put that document up into the Adobe Connect. So thanks for that, Christine. And I have Kathy and then Rebecca.
Yeah. First, thanks to Christine for her work. I would recommend we actually start with the analysis group material and go through it and that last section just to kind of refresh our recollection. And I'm not sure that it wasn't well written for the purpose that it was intended. And so I would recommend we start there, then move over to Christine's and see how it addresses the issues of concern. But I'd start with the analysis group because it was a good question for the purpose. And I just wanted to do as a premise, and I just wanted to confirm with the analysis group that this is not a survey of registrants who have seen trademark claims notices, right? I wanted to confirm that. I wanted to confirm that you're talking to 500 registrants and that it's possible that none of them have ever seen a trademark claims notice. And so let's start with that. And again, the idea that we might start, review where we started with the analysis group and then move on to Christine's. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Tushnet, thank you. Just two things. I do think it is important to have a concrete example. I still think that if we just ask them, like, I wanted to start a blog, we're not going to get really good answers because they won't know, well, did the blog have anything to do with the domain name that I got the notice for? Because, if I want to start a blog at even virtue.food, if it's not about food and eating well, I don't really know why I would proceed having receive the notice. It seems odd. The other concern that I have, I love Christine's breakdown, but I think as a matter of survey practice, it's probably not a great idea to present all of them to all the respondents, because they're going to start making internal comparisons. Their answers are going to be thrown off by the presence of the other options, right? So they're going to start rating and ranking in ways that they might not if they just received the notice for some particular thing that they had done or that they wanted to do. So, you know, again, I want to ask Stacy, but my sense is that unless we can subgroup in some way, we should not ask. I mean, maybe we can get away with two, but they should be presented separately. But I really want to hear from Stacy on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Perhaps we can hear from Stacy and then switch to Christine. Stacy?
Hi, thanks. This is Stacy. I'm looking at the questions that Christine had drafted. That's what we're discussing. Is that right?
No. This is Kathy. Two questions for you, Stacy. One, how many registrants are you interviewing? Two, do the registrants all have to have registered new GTLDs? Three, do any of them have to have seen a trademark claims notice as a threshold for being interviewed? Like, will they all have seen trademark claims notices? How are you identifying registrants? So three questions for you at the outset about the survey. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. This is Stacy again. So for the registrant survey, in our original proposal, we had suggested that we would work with ICANN to do outreach to the registrant group. So that will be the group that we'll be focusing our efforts on. Whether or not they need to have registered in a domain in a new GTLD, that is one of the early filtering questions in the registrant survey. So they'll be asked if they've registered in a new GTLD, and if so, then they continue on with the survey, and if not, then they may be filtered over to the potential registrant survey. To clarify, this hypothetical question is now being proposed for both the registrant and potential registrant surveys. And then the last question, whether or not they need to have seen a claims notice in order, as we had originally drafted this section, they do not necessarily have to have seen a claims notice, which is why here it's suggested that when they start this section of the survey, they'll be shown an example of a claims notice.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
And I see Christine and Michael, please.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to weigh in on the survey is currently drafted by analysis group. To what Stacy said, I mean, they have to be part of a GTLD. They have to have tried to register a domain in the GTLDs. They may or may not have been presented with notice. But if you read back, it says, like, if you were presented with a claims notice, what did you think? I mean, it asked follow-up questions about that specific interaction. I think our conversation last time was it didn't go as deep as it should have. So I think we definitely do want to go dig a little bit more into, you know, what the person thought about the claims notice. I mean, I think we talked about how it wasn't super clear, but there is a section for that. But then you move on to another section, which we are surveying people who have already seen a claims notice and say, yes, I've seen one. So that's one complete section of the survey. Then we move on to sort of a generic, like, all right, so whether or not you've seen one, I'm going to show you a claims notice again because it might have been 2 or 3 years. Then this section is for those people. And I think it would be interesting, and as the analysis group pointed out last year, or last call, it feels like a year ago in some ways, as analysis group pointed out in the last call, if you do the questions in such a way that you can get like a one-to-one correlation, so we ask current registrants, what do you think of the claims notice? Here's five questions. You ask potential registrants, what do you think of the claims notice? Here are the same five questions. You'll actually get two different sets of responses for the exact same questions based on two different profiles. So you'll be able to bifurcate and say people who have already registered domain names answer this way, and people who have never registered a domain name have registered answered this way. So it's kind of interesting. Or we might find out that it's the same across both sets. So I think that's actually the way the survey is currently broken out by analysis group is correct. For the purposes of this conversation, we are only talking about the sort of great, whether you've registered a domain name in the past or not, whether you've seen a claims notice in the past or not. Now we're going to ask you five questions that are specific to the claims notice. We want to try to not dig into how much do you know about trademark law, because now you've got a survey of what do respondents know, or, you know, domain name registrants know about trademark law. So that's why we need to kind of bifurcate. So that's for context, I wanted to back up because that is where this is at. That's just this part is just about trying to get a uniform set of examples about the claims notice itself. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. Michael, please.
Michael, for the transcript. And I guess my question has to do with that, and my suggestion earlier in response to looking at Christine's suggested revisions, which I do like. But my question in that regard is whether or not we contaminate the responses of those who have seen claims notices by having them go through then this set of possibilities. Initially, my thought was, well, you know, if they did receive a claims notice, then they would go through a set of questions. They could be reflective of these, but they would be based on the understanding of that applicant. And then if they did not receive claims notice, then they would come over to this line of questioning, the second line of questioning, so that they would not have received claims notice, propose their answers, then come into this second analysis and rethink perhaps what they had answered initially. And I'm just concerned that there might be some some infection of those earlier answers by these, and again, I'm going to call them hypotheticals because they really are, of these hypotheticals where we're asking how would you react to this if you saw this. I think we do want to ask this, but I wonder if we are doing this second level with those who also answered as people who received claims notices, if there's a way of protecting those earlier answers from being infected by these. And that would be my concern. And then secondly, Christine's point I think is excellent, being able to have the two classes of respondents and be able to compare to see if there is a difference between the two I think is really important to this. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Michael. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Tushnet, thank you. So I think good to be able to reassure people, both of those things are standard survey practice. So the way that you protect against contamination is by keeping the survey moving forward. So it is temporally impossible for exposure to these use cases, hypotheticals, what have you, to infect the answers because we ask about the actual claims notices, if any, first. I would not be concerned about that. And then, of course, from everything analysis group has said, I expect them to follow the standard practice of letting us break down the groups by whatever divisions that we are interested in. So, I do want to emphasize, though, that as far as I'm concerned, we're still talking about the single use case in the original survey for the reasons that I articulated, that if we don't separate them, we're going to start getting a non-representative of the standard conditions scenario, which is not going to help us to figure out how actual registrants understand this. So, again, you know, if we subsell So if we really did get 200 potential registrants, 50 in a subcell seems perfectly acceptable, and we could do four different use cases. But I just want to make sure, and I would like Stacey to talk a little bit about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Kathy and then Michael, and then I would like to go to Stacey because I think we've gotten teed up a few questions for her as far as some procedural items. So Kathy and then Michael.
Yeah. Julie, could you put up the original that we're looking at and position it on the last question? Because I just wanted to reference it and what I'm going to talk about.
Kathy, this is Julie from staff. Do you mean the RFP appendix, which was the original questions that were sent to analysis group, or do you mean the survey that analysis group provided that is the Google Doc?
Good question. The latter, the analysis group document.
Okay, that is actually only a link. That there's no good way to show it in the Adobe Connect, so we've been doing the link. Yeah, so the link is in the agenda here on the left, but I'll go ahead.
No. I thought it was the opening document when we came in.
The only document we've shown so far is this one that you see in front of you, which is Christine's suggestion.
You don't have the analysis group document as edited by Rebecca, who was the head of our group on that one.
That's always just been a Google Doc. So we've always just followed along in the Google Doc for those. And so that's the link that we've shared right here. Because if we try to save them as Word documents and show them in the Adobe Connect room, we're going to lose all the edits. You won't be able to see them. So because in PDF, the edits disappear. So that's why we've been using the links.
Okay. Then if people would go to the link. So first, since I wasn't here at the very beginning, right at the very top, and this is a question for Stacey, we used three examples, none of which are new GTLDs. One's .com, that's legacy, one's .uk, and one's .de. They're both ccTLDs. If we're going to use examples, I think, and put people in the frame of mind for new GTLDs, it might be petdogs.love, shoes.horse, and amazon.shop, just so we get people out of the older TLD mindset. Stacey, does that make any sense? That wasn't the purpose of this, but if we're paging through it, I just wanted to pause. Does that make any sense? Does anybody object to that?
Okay, so I have two hands up. I have Michael and Christine.
Well, no, I've got that wasn't why I was in the document. I was just pausing for say. I did want to go down to the. I don't think it's a hypothesis. It's really a use case, and I wanted to ask again why, since the people, since Rebecca has been a trademark expert at the Federal Trade Commission, and they use this type of example, virtue.food. They use this type of example in. At the Federal Trade Commission and other work that she's done as an expert. Since the analysis group offered it to us, and since we used exactly the same type of example when we were dealing with registrants and the first Who Is review team, when we were surveying registrants around the world, I don't understand. If it helps focus the questions and the data and will help us parse the data when it comes in, I guess I'm still missing why, and the other ways of more general data gathering don't give us that focus and knowledge because we don't know what's in the registrant's head. Why wouldn't we use the one that's designed to give us quicker and dirtier and cleaner data? I guess I'm still missing this. Thanks. And so I'm on, the last question of the original document from the analysis group on registrant survey. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. I have Michael and Christine, please.
Hi, Michael, for the record, thanks. Going back, Rebecca, yes, I understand. I've been involved in surveys forever, and yes, if you have a forward track and cannot go back, you can't infect. I did not hear that was the case with this survey, but if it is, then I think that is the solution. A lot of these surveys, though, are set up to allow you to go back and change your answers before the end, so that would be my concern. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Christine, please.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine. I'm very confused. I'm not sure if we're just all speaking a totally different language and we're just talking over each other and saying the same thing, if we're saying something totally different but using the same language. So where I come from, we talk about use cases and we talk about scenarios, and what I provided are use cases. What I'm hearing, and this is what I'm not entirely sure about, is if looking at the analysis group document, I guess what I really want to hear from maybe Rebecca and or Kathy is, what do you think it should look like then? I've put my idea of what I think it should look like out there. I understand that people disagree with that, and that's fine. It's a straw document. We can decide we hate it. That's fine. But the rationale was that I thought that you two wanted more specific sort of stories or situations that dove a little deeper to figure out, like, what people would do in various scenarios when presented with the claims notice. Giving them a single domain name does not allow us to unpack any of the baggage around what they might think that domain name stands for. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that. Secondly, and this is just for the analysis group, giving Kathy's sort of example of changing the example names at the front, I didn't object to Amazon.com at the top because that's an actual domain name that Amazon uses and it's pretty famous. But I do object to you saying Amazon.shop because that is not something that Amazon does its business under at this time. So you can choose something else, please, for that if you're going to use a .shop example. But going back down to question 2G, whatever it is going on down there, I would really love to hear if Rebecca could or someone could walk us through what they were thinking, because I understood that Rebecca did not like Q2G and its progeny any more than I did. And so I would be super excited to hear what it is that you were looking for, because apparently I think I'm walking past you. I'm apparently missing it. So thanks.
Thanks so much, Christine. And Michael, is that a new hand?
Oh, no, sorry, old hand.
And Rebecca, to Christine's question, please, go ahead.
Rebecca Toshnet, sorry, I did the checkbox instead of the raised hand. So, Christine, I love the stuff you've done. What I'm concerned about is the stuff that you took away, right? So the key issue for me has always been that if we give a claims notice and then say X, you know, for the string that you entered, then we are telling the respondent to make up some X, and different respondents will make up different X's and they'll be answering different questions. And so the virtue.food example is really useful because it actually helps you say, okay, now I know what I'm looking at. And, you know, it may well be that there's somebody out there with a valid, you know, virtue trademark. And now I have to think about how nervous that makes me given what I know I'm going to use this for. So I actually think I like your scenarios. Like I said, if we're getting enough people to subgroup, I'd just like to spread them out among the different respondents. I just don't want to ask the same person, you know, multiple times because then they'll start rating and ranking in a way that probably does not match actual registrant experience. Since, as you say, registrants come in with, you know, some sort of goal in mind. My concern is that we not remove a domain name and make them make one up, because they are going to make one up, right? So we can't actually have a survey that doesn't ask them to imagine some domain name. All we can do is lose control over what it is that they're going to imagine. And other than that, you know, if we, I'm totally happy with your examples. I just don't think that it's representative of the actual environment to ask them all together. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Lori, Christine, and Michael. Lori, please.
Sorry, can you hear me? My mic is vibrating, just want to make sure I can be heard.
And you're a little bit muffled, but we can hear you.
Okay, I'm on a different headset today, so my apologies, trying to make this work the best I can. I heard that the analysis is going to go to paid respondents. There'll be a pool of broad people who are volunteers to do this work. And I guess I'm still unclear as to whether or not there's going to be a threshold question asked as to whether or not this particular group has ever applied for and abandoned a purchase of a domain name. Because I think if that's not the case, if there's no thresholding at all, then I think what Christine is doing makes complete sense. However, if there is threshold questions being asked, perhaps I'd more fall along the lines of what Rebecca is arguing. But I'm still not clear who's answering these questions and how much background they really have.
Thank you. So before I move to Christine and then Michael, is it helpful again? I think Stacy did state earlier, but Lori, you may not have been on the call at that point, to whom we are asking this question, or if there is a threshold question to this set of questions. Seems there's still some confusion there. Stacy?
Thanks. This is Stacy. Yeah, so there is the current filter for this set of hypothetical questions is that the respondent has at some point attempted to make a registration in an HETLD and did not complete the registration. So right now, it's suggested that these hypothetical questions are presented to potential registrants, so people who never completed a domain name registration, but also in the registrant survey, if they completed registrations, it is also possible that they attempted some registrations and didn't complete them. And so if that's the case, if they did complete but also attempted and did not complete some, then they will be filtered into this hypothetical situation as well.
Thank you, Stacy. Christine, and then Michael.
Thanks. This is Christine. So I have a follow-up question for Rebecca. I think I'm starting to see a little bit more about what you're saying here. I disagree that I think people who are here taking this survey for this, you know, being told, by the time they get to this point in the survey and they understand, you know, there's all the registration of domain names, I think they're going to be sophisticated enough to understand that people register domain names for different uses. And I would be interested to find out more about this taint that you're referring to, because I'm not, I think people would come in. I mean, if you gave me this survey, and granted, I've been in this industry a while, and you said, should I register virtue.food? I would have so many questions. I'm like, well, maybe. What am I going to do with it? I mean, I think that's important, and I think that people will get frustrated with when they're told, well, here's your specific use case, decide. But be that as it may, I mean, I'm not the survey expert, and maybe that's a problem. But my question goes back to even maybe a more basic question. So let's go back to the original header. Assume you were attempting to register, and we say the domain name virtue.food and receive the following claim notice. Do you then also have to say, you know, that there is a, I mean, are you assuming the claim, and maybe this is the problem, I'm assuming that we're just going to show a generic claims notice that's been kind of random, genericized. Are you saying that you would actually say that there is a trademark for virtue in the class of goods and services related to, I don't even know, and, you know, therefore, blah, blah, blah. I mean, maybe that's what my understanding, maybe that's where my breakdown is I thought we were going to send out a generic claims notice instead of something specific to the word virtue that we're just going to sort of fabricate. Maybe you can address that a little bit more, and maybe that's where part of my confusion is. So we're going to fabricate that. Okay, I see that. And then I'm going to jump way ahead, and so this is for analysis group in the future. We also talked about surveying people in different languages. Are people also going to see the same thing in different languages as well? So I would love to hear more about this rationale that says users can't distinguish between the different use cases and think about how they might use a domain name based on what a different scenario might be and why you would want to randomize that. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And Rebecca, I see a green check mark, but I'm not sure if that's a hand up. Michael, please.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for the record. And I guess I just sort of have a question. It's either a question or a comment, and that's if we were going ahead and utilizing, as Rebecca was discussing, a sample so that there could be focus and we could, you know, have a unified set of responses because it's to that particular example. My concern is that if we give them any type of particular example, that has a huge potential for affecting the results as well. Virtue, obviously, is clearly a generic term when it's used in connection with virtue, and it's not in connection with other goods or services. So presumably this is someone who maybe thought they would just register the domain name. We're not aware that there was a trademark. Okay, well, that's one case. How about another case where it's clearly a trademark, Xerox, dot yours, whatever? That would be a different line of responses, I think. So I think if we are going to give an example, we might have to give a couple of examples to cover that field. Otherwise, we're going to be affecting the results based on our selection of that result. So just wanted to point that out. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Dushnet, sorry. Christine, I'm so sorry. I clearly have not communicated that I really like your examples. I think you're exactly right that people do approach the registration process with something particular in mind, and so it helps to focus them and to make the survey more like what a real registrant would be thinking by having a use case in mind. So the question is that I have is merely one of survey administration, which is to say because they do have something in mind. I think it can be troublesome to present them a whole list and ask them to, you know, say what they do because they may start shaping their answers by comparison. Like, I'd go ahead with this one but not with this one. And that is actually not representative of what an actual registration process would be like, where you do, in general, have something in mind, whether that's building a portfolio or something else. So let me throw – I'm also certainly happy to add in a Xerox one. I think that'd be useful information, too. If you want to – Xerox.food for all these. What I then think we need to talk about, first of all, I think, again, we need to be doing some subgrouping, and we need to do some randomization and rotation. So, you know, if we want to do a Xerox and a Virtue for all four of these, that's great. We just make sure that every respondent gets one Xerox and one Virtue and randomize. And I think that would be really helpful, actually. But again, this is why I want Stacy to talk a little bit about the making the survey as similar to the actual what the registrant would be doing as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca, Christine, and then I'll ask Stacy to address that point. Christine, please.
Thanks. This is Christine, and I appreciate that, Rebecca. I think I'm really starting to understand more about what you're looking for. I will stop asking this question because I might be the only one on here who's not understanding this, and it probably truly is some sort of survey administration, like, protocol that I am just unfamiliar with. The idea of only giving people one domain name, I'm not dying on the hill of one domain name. That's fine. But in only one use case to kind of pick and choose with everyone's life experiences, and we're only having 50 surveys to start with, I guess I don't understand why people can't rank and pick and choose. If you're presented with these four options, maybe you'll say, I'm going to proceed with all four. Or maybe you're the super cautious type. Oh, I'm going to stop every single time. I guess that's the part I'm missing, is I don't understand why everybody can't see them all. That's And then I don't need to have, like, you know, the MBA course on surveying. If you just tell me, of course, Christine, if Stacy tells me, well, you guys tell me that's just not how it's done, fine, tell me it's not how it's done and I'll stop. But I don't understand it because I don't understand why they can't. I've been presented with many surveys where I rank and randomize. I rank things and I say, should I be able to do 1, 2, 3, or 4? Yes to all, yes to some, yes to none. So I'd love to hear some more about that. Secondly, I am strongly opposed to using actual brands that we actually know about, especially names that are arbitrary and distinctive, and even more so names that have been in danger of genericide in the past. So I think if you use Xerox, for example, A, it's an arbitrary and distinctive term, and you and I in the United States might realize that that is such a case, but people presented other places might not understand that. Also, there is a small subgroup of people that actually think Xeroxing is a verb and that is not a trademark. So I think we run into major danger if we choose a mark that we already know about. I'm fine if we use Virtue, assuming that we're sort of willfully blind and we don't go look it up. But a truly famous mark, I'm strongly opposed to including that. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. I have Susan and then Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, it's Susan. I'm late joining, so I've only sort of come in partway through this conversation, but I just wanted to say I don't think you're the only one, Christine, who doesn't understand. I think the various sort of scenarios that you were suggesting, I can't see why you can't ask them of everyone. I think it would be quite helpful for the reasons you say, that we're probably going to have a limited pool, and so it would be useful to understand what their thinking would be, the same person's thinking would be in different scenarios as well.
Thank you, Susan. Rebecca, and then Kathy.
Rebecca Tushnet. I really want an analysis group to speak to this. The reason that I am insisting on this, I will give up if I hear someone who does this tell me it's not worrisome. My background in surveys suggests that a survey does best when it most closely replicates the circumstances under which the potential, in this case, registrant, is proceeding. So if they ask you to think like you ordinarily think when you're doing things of this nature, that's the best survey possible. Now, I've only registered a few domain names in my life, so I may not be particularly representative, but when Christine said, registrants have something in mind, that struck me as correct. So the reason that I object to especially a simultaneous presentation, serial presentation, you can do some things to correct for it, like randomizing the order. But a simultaneous presentation starts to ask the potential registrant to do things differently than they would if they were actually thinking about making the registration. So I feel like the analysis group really should have been offered an opportunity to answer my question, which is now the third time I'm asking. Can we talk about what's the best way to get people to behave as close as possible to how they actually would if they were actually trying to register? Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I think at this point we need to go to analysis group. So Stacy and Greg, please.
Thank you, Julie. This is Greg speaking for the record. So, Rebecca, I completely agree with your kind of the point that you're making and the concern that you raised. One thing I guess I would like to throw out there as an option to address it, and, of course, we look forward to your feedbacks and reactions to it, would be to have a type of screening question where we essentially ask people, if you were going to register a domain name or when you registered domain names in the past, what are you most likely to be registering that domain name for? So are you doing it because you're thinking of starting a business using that name, or are you trying to start your own personal blog or something like that? And then based on the answer to that screening question, you would be kind of ported, or you would then be funneled into the question that I think we're currently looking at, or kind of the grid that we're currently looking at. And so if you only said that you were thinking of starting a business using that name, you would then be asked, only provided with that as an option, and then kind of, would you proceed with the registration, would you stop, et cetera, et cetera. And some people might say they were thinking of starting a business, and sometimes they've also in the past started or thought about starting a blog using that name. And so if they did that, then they would see two of the four options, or I guess, yeah, two of the four options in this grid. So I'll stop there, but Stacey, anything to add? No.
Thanks, and I see, Rebecca, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Sorry, Rebecca Tashnet. I just said in the chat, if that will, if that suggestion gets us to where we want to go, great. You know, obviously we might not end up with equal subgroups, but I can live with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I see in the chat, Michael is saying, Christine, but if you're agreeing, if you agree asking about reaction to claims notice on a generic descriptive term would be different from a more distinctive type of term, perhaps we clarify that we're not asking about adoption of terms that are similar to known trademarks. Susan says funneling could work, although we might not get any respondents for some scenarios. And Christine, please go ahead.
Thank you. This is Christine. That's been very helpful. And I just want to be clear that I really am truly trying to understand. So thanks to everyone for their patience. A couple of comments. I'll respond to Michael. I was going to type it, but why not just say it into the, you know, microphone? So I think that what I'm understanding is that we're offering a pretend scenario. Nobody wants to throw their trademark up on the altar of this survey. So I think what we're talking about is a pretend scenario. So if we leave in the original scenario term, which is virtue.food, and we don't actually, you know, we think that's not a trademark. Certainly we've never heard of it. And then we provide a claims notice. So the domain name is virtue.food. We provide a claims notice for this artificial trademark virtue. I think in this case, in theory, this would be sort of arbitrary and distinctive because virtue, generally speaking, is not going to be a trademark for, I don't think, anything. And just don't even want to go there and think about what it could be generic, distinctive, generic or descriptive for. So I'm thinking that that's where they're headed. I'm not opining. I'm just trying to answer your question, that actually the example that we're providing is somewhat arbitrary. I'm also thinking about the funneling. I think it's creative and interesting, and I think I'm thinking that it could work. Again, not the survey expert, but I'm also concerned that with Susan that it might be too limiting. I know we've talked about offering the survey to 50 respondents. Can we talk about maybe opening it up to more, or is it the fact that maybe I'm going to answer my own question. Maybe if we ask this exact section, whatever, however it looks at the end of the day, to both current respondents and potential respondents, we're going to get the 50 current respondents and the 200 potentials, in which case we get a much bigger pool of people, in which case maybe I'm a little bit less nervous. So maybe Stacey or Greg could talk to the numbers of the funneling and how the funneling would work if we use the 50 versus the 200 versus both. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate everyone's patience with my ignorance on this.
Thanks so much, Christine. And Greg and Stacey, please.
Sure. This is Greg again. So I think we'll want to ask this question of both registrants and potential registrants. So that gets us 250, as Christine noted. I think, you know, we can certainly open up the registrant survey to more people. You know, to some extent, as large of a number of individuals as we can get, to some extent, the better. So I don't think we certainly didn't kind of intend to restrict the survey to 50 respondents, and once we got 50, we would close the survey. So I think we're more than willing to have additional people beyond the 50 respond to the survey, which would hopefully increase the odds that we would get at least some people who would be funneled into each of these options. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Susan, please.
Thanks. So I have a question, and apologies if you've already covered it, or I'm asking a stupid question. But so in this scenario, virtue.food, we're going to give them a claims notice. And I can't remember. I'm sorry, I haven't got the claims notice in front of me. But is that going to what this notional trademark for virtue is registered for? Because if not, should one of our scenarios be, I would, you know, look up what the trademark is registered for? Because I still think we're coming out with a solution where we don't know what the person is thinking when they are ticking the various boxes of whether they'll proceed or not. And their decision on whether to proceed would be different depending on what the trademark is registered for.
Thank you, Susan. I'm not sure who wants to answer that question. I think Rebecca had said before that the idea was that if we say virtue.food, that we would show a claims notice that would be for virtue.food. But let me put that out there and see what the understanding is, or if we go this route. And Christine, please.
Thanks. Yeah, this is Christine. Susan, it's my understanding that what we're going to do is fictionalize a complete claims notice as you would normally see it. So we're going to tell them you want to register virtue.food. You are presented with this claims notice. So it's going to say virtue at the top of the page, and then it's going to show a claims notice one would normally receive it or normally see it. Presented to a domain name registrant. So it would have all the normal elements, but we would just fictionalize anything that was, you know, not for real. I think that what we're talking about here is we want them to decide, I mean, if there's no, so the actual claims notice has goods and services as part of it, so we would have to fictionalize that. And, you know, I'm not even sure, like, I'm sure that's a whole separate phone call. And then from there, the user could decide, and if you look at the grid that I have, which is on the screen, it was if you're seeing the claims notice for virtue and then these specific goods and services and international classes, for some people that actually has meaning, and they might say proceed with the registration or I'm going to stop or I'm going to talk to a lawyer or whatever. For some people that might mean nothing, but it doesn't, I don't know that it truly matters because ultimately at the end of the day, people are just going to be making decisions with the information they have available to them at the time. So I don't know, Susan, if that answers your question or if you have more of that, but I see your hand up. So go ahead and jump in, and I'll see if I can, if we can answer from there. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. So right, yes, I took the opportunity while you were speaking to do what I should have done initially, which was look up a claims notice and remind myself what's in it. But so, yes, yeah, so the claims notice has the mark and it has the goods and services covered. So my question is, assuming we're fictionalizing this claims notice, we have to decide if this is, you know, someone in a scenario who wants to register virtue.food and we've got a fictional mark virtue, well, what is virtue registered for? Which class and which goods and services? Because we have to decide. Yeah, it does. Rebecca, in response to your question, yes, it does. It says, I think it does anyway, according to the one that's in the trademark RPM's requirements, it includes details of the mark.
Thank you, Susan. Christine, please.
Yeah, this is Christine. Okay, so I think we've established that it does include the goods and services, and so that's interesting. I think that in this, I don't know, Kathy says that should we leave this to the analysis group? I think we need to direct the analysis group because what we want to do here is just this claims notice has to be written, and I don't think the analysis group is an expert on a claims notice, so I think we want to decide, and I think what we're trying to do is not set people up for an actual cyber squatting experience. So I think to the extent that we're attempting to register virtue.food, I don't think you want to have virtue in the class of goods and services for restaurants or for produce, right? I think we want to have virtue in the class of goods and services for something else. Because if you've got, I mean, if this is an actual, if you're, we don't need to set people up to be cyber squatters because we already know that it should be deterring cyber squatters. And if it's not, well, we've got, you know, they've got a problem and they're going to get a UDRP or a lawsuit. I think we want those people out. So we really want this set up in a situation where we're not setting it up as a cyber squatter. So maybe this answers Susan's question. Oh, Susan says, or Rebecca says for medical equipment. Okay. Oh, I didn't see the link for medical equipment. I didn't understand that. Okay. Yeah, I agree. There you go. Thanks. I think medical equipment's fine. Thanks.
Thank you. So I'm not seeing anybody else in the queue at this moment. It seems like we are coalescing on agreement to use virtue as the for the claims notice and as the example. And then, as Rebecca is pointing out, that the service would be goods or service would be medical equipment,
But then we would go with the grid that Christine has provided. Does anyone disagree with that? Christine, please.
This is Christine. I don't know that we were going with a grid. I believe that the ultimate decision there was to use a funnel and ask people what they would do with such a domain name, and then ask them questions based on their own possible use cases, not hypothetical, would not be something related to them. I'm just trying to make sure I've captured that correctly, that we did coalesce around the idea of a funnel, not the grid for everyone.
Thank you, Christine, for remembering the funnel, and apologies from staff for not. Susan, please.
Yeah, thanks, and apologies, and I'm sorry for dragging this out. But now that I've seen the example that Rebecca very kindly posted us that link, it looks like that is a genuine example. So there is a trademark for Virtue, and it is registered for medical supplies. So surely I thought we just had an agreement we weren't going to use someone's actual trademark. And now it seems like we've deliberately selected one that is.
Please go ahead, Rebecca.
Rebecca Tashnet, thank you. So, Susan, I believe we've discussed this on Friday. There is no chance that an English word is not registered by someone for something. There's actually a great article on this that just came out in the Harvard Law Review called Are We Running Out of Trademarks? And the answer is if you don't consider goods and services, clearly yes. There's pretty much nothing. So we don't really have choices here. Now, what we can do is pretty easily choose something that clearly has limited rights. Virtue for medical equipment, I have no reason to doubt that it's a valid mark, but also I think anyone can see that it can't possibly give them a monopoly over Virtue in all goods and services. We definitely did not agree. I said specifically that I was pretty certain that there was a Virtue out there, and now my intuition was correct with a valid Virtue mark. The question is, what is a reasonable example to use for consumers? That's it. Thanks.
Okay, so we're putting this out there then as a reasonable example, recognizing the fact that it does exist in the wild, so to speak. Kathy, please.
Yeah. Given that Phil and I and probably everybody are Googling Virtue right now and finding it, would it make people more comfortable to make up a Virtue? Sorry about that. That sounds weird. But make up a Virtue for, I don't know, doors, windows, vases, purses, something that is in a, you know, pick your jurisdiction. Would that make people comfortable and move this forward? Because I'm not sure we have to use a real trademark. They're just easier to use because they're out there. Thanks.
And thank you, Kathy. And I see Rebecca saying, happy to make up Virtue for doors. And Phyllis typing. So where we stand then would be Virtue for doors, and we would use a funnel to then sort of direct the responses. Let me ask, we have 4 minutes left. This is only a 60-minute slot. We have another 60-minute slot that we'll be announcing that's for Wednesday. We'll have the working group meet for 30 minutes to just do brief updates, and then we'll have 60 minutes again for what we hope will be discussing the potential registrant survey. But let me ask Stacey and Greg, are you clear on where we stand now? And Rebecca, I see your hands up too. So let me just defer to you and then to Greg and Stacey. Or is that an old hand? And thanks, Christine, noted. Okay, so Greg and Stacey, no hands are up right now. Do you have a sense of where we stand?
Hi, this is Stacey. Yes, this was all very helpful. Thanks. I think we do have pretty good direction for this section.
Oh, wonderful. Well,
yeah, no questions here.
Great news. All right. So 3 minutes left. I think we have gone to the end of this, and we know where we stand of the registrant survey. And the plan for Wednesday, Susan, was we originally had the time slot at the normal working group time slot. And I know you asked that question before, Susan, so it's good to repeat this. The co-chairs have talked about this. Originally, this subteam was going to meet from 1700 to 1830, but the co-chairs would like to use the first 30 minutes of that slot for just a full working group brief meeting so that we can all get on the same page with respect to what is happening in ICANN 62 and any updates from the subteams that we're looking at data, and then, but not this particular subteam, then the remaining 60 minutes from 1730 to 1830 would be for this subteam. And I apologize, we were going to send an announcement out about this, which we will shortly, and then a new calendar invite. So that's where we stand right now. And thank you, Susan, for asking that question. Anybody have anything else they want to raise before we adjourn the call? Lori's typing, so we'll give Lori a moment. Sorry, Lori. Apologies for that. We are trying to close things up as we can, recognizing how difficult it is for. Sorry about that, Lori.
Yeah, but I just want to. Yeah, I know, and I'm trying to be a good scout about this, but this is the last week that I will do this. I will not do it after ICANN 62. There is so much other going on, folks. If we can't figure out a way to do more of it on the list or something more efficiently, I question whether I can be engaged anymore. This is really becoming a problem for productivity in other areas. When I add up the hours of meeting, hours of review, getting ready for the meeting, and then relay the results of the meeting, it is becoming unbearable. I don't know how else to say it.
And we totally understand, and apologies for the pace and the multiple meetings. We are hoping that this Wednesday meeting will be enough to be able to finish things off so that we will not need more meetings. That's our goal. But thank you all for your dedication. We really appreciate it. And now it's top of the hour, and we will adjourn the call. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Julie. Operator, can you go ahead and stop the recordings, please? And everyone, enjoy the rest of your day or night.